Big news, everyone. We just released two new training programs. First up, our second generation Strength One program, which is designed for folks who are trying to get stronger on the squat, the bench press, the deadlift, and the overhead press. It includes four 12-week programs, and users can now pick their own exercises, choose between 3 or 4 day options, and choose to focus on either the bench press or the overhead press, in addition to the squat and the deadlift. The programming has also been overhauled to drive better results based on testing and user feedback. Next, we also launched our second generation Time Crunch program, which is designed for busy professionals, parents, and other on-the-go lifters who want to maximize results without spending hours upon hours in the gym. This one includes six 12-week programs, ranging from longer workouts that are performed 2 days per week to shorter workouts performed daily and everything in between. No matter what your availability is, we have something for you. Both programs can be done with basic gym equipment like a bar, rack, and weights, but they can also be modified to use more specialized equipment in the gym if you like. Both programs also include a brand new ebook that includes details on the program, training theory, nutrition, supplements, and more. If you previously purchased the first generation of these programs, check your email for instructions on how to upgrade to the latest version. For everyone else who wants to get the most out of their training, head over to barbellmedicine.com and check out these new training programs. Here from Barbell Medicine, and we'll get to the podcast in just a moment, but I wanted to take a second to plug a special promotion for Barbell Medicine Plus, our exclusive subscription service. From now until the end of February, we're offering 2 free months for new monthly subscribers or 40% off yearly memberships. If you hate these ads just as much as we do, you should know that Barbell Medicine Plus members get ad-free episodes, early access to our podcast, that's both audio and video, expert-written episode summaries, extended samples to our newest templates, access to a members-only podcast where Dr. Baraki and I answer your questions directly, and more exclusive content as well. If you want to support what we're doing and become a Barbell Medicine Plus member, now with a discount, head over to barbellmedicine.com/plus and sign up to be a Barbell Medicine Plus member today. That's barbellmedicine.com/plus to help us out and get rid of these ads for good. Thanks for your support. Now on to the podcast. Welcome back to the Barbell Medicine Podcast, where we bring modern medicine to strength and conditioning and strength and conditioning to modern medicine. I'm your host, Dr. Jordan Feigenbaum, and this is our fifth Ask Me Anything for our Barbell Medicine Plus subscribers. If you are a Barbell Medicine Plus member, thank you so much for supporting what we do here at Barbell Medicine. The reason why you're hearing this, if you're not a Barbell Medicine Plus member, well, don't adjust your radio dials, don't adjust your TVs. Everything is fine. This is a free promo because we're running a special on our Barbell Medicine Plus subscription this month. So to the end of February 2025, take up to 40% off joining the Barbell Medicine Plus membership. So you get ad-free listening, you get videos, you get exclusive content like extended access to templates that we're just releasing. That's all for free, of course. You get expert summaries for each podcast. You get this Ask Me Anything that we do every month. You can field questions to Dr. Baraki and myself. And yeah, people seem to like it. So that's going on through the end of February. So you can check all that stuff out in the link in the description below. But before we go any further, before we get into the questions, I got to introduce the second most handsome doctor in North America, Dr. Austin Baraki. What's going on, man?
Hey, doing all right. Excited to be here for another month of Q&As. I was just telling you before we got started, I just took a little mini road trip down to Big Bend National Park. Figured I'm actually going to be probably moving this summer again from West Texas. So while I was here, I thought I'd check that national park out while I have a chance. So it was a pretty cool experience. It felt like I was literally in Westworld season one, which I've not like Googled this. I suspect I'm far from the only person to ever make this observation, but it is this gargantuan, like 1200 square mile national park that could easily be where they shot that that show. So yeah, really cool.
Yeah, I was looking at some of the stuff that you and your wife had posted, and I was like, oh, this looks cool. I mean, I assume that Westworld was filmed somewhere in California, Inland Empire or something like that, but yeah, where you guys went looked really cool. And I just learned, you just told me this, that the Big Bend National Park is actually in the Big Bend of the state of Texas, like geographically, the way the state looks. Yeah, I didn't know that. I don't know where I would have thought it was before, but look, I had to learn that today. So now the audience has to learn that as well. So if you know, you know. All right. Well, let's get into this month's Ask Me Anything. Again, if you are a Barbell Medicine Plus subscriber, thank you so much for supporting what we do here at Barbell Medicine. If you're not, well, look, this is just a smattering of some of the questions that we got. And we tap our whole team to actually answer some of these questions. So we'll hear from Dr. Derek Miles. We'll hear from Leah Lutz as well. First question, though. How much potential is left when we don't do leg extensions for quadriceps hypertrophy and strength? Is it really the only exercise besides the sissy squat that affects the development of the rectus femoris? Are squats and one-legged work enough? Dr. Baraki, what do you think about this before I dive into my answer?
Yeah, I think that this person clearly has been in the space of online fitness conversations over the past few years, because this is something that's been a topic of conversation. And so I think that we would come at this question from two different angles. With respect to strength, as it relates to your general life function, as it relates to healthy aging, as it relates to a maximum squat performance, if you wanted to be a competitive strength sport barbell athlete like a powerlifter, I don't think you're missing out on a ton by not doing leg extensions or sissy squats. If your goal is oriented around absolute maximum hypertrophy for the quadriceps muscles to include the rectus femoris, then I would be in favor of you including that particular exercise. And the reasons why have to do with some anatomy and some biomechanics around the different quadriceps muscles, where they originate, where they attach, and how they act, and how they behave differently in these two different types of movements, like squatting and one-legged work, versus something like a leg extension or a sissy squat. And it has to do with the fact that the rectus femoris is what's known as a biarticular muscle, meaning that the rectus femoris crosses two joints. It crosses both the hip joint and it crosses the knee joint. So it can participate in active hip flexion. For example, if you are doing, say, a hanging leg raise or something like that, that's a movement where your rectus femoris is actually going to be involved to some extent, active hip flexion. And it's also involved in knee extension, like when you're standing up out of the bottom of a squat or indeed during a leg extension. Since during a squat and a single leg work, like a split squat, for example, you have the simultaneous flexion of the hip and extension of the knee, the rectus femoris actually doesn't do a ton or doesn't receive a ton of stimulus for hypertrophy in that context, as compared with during a leg extension where the hip is not really moving, the hip is not flexing or extending, but the knees are extending. And so the rectus femoris are in a position to contribute to a more significant degree to that action. And so if I were to predict, you may feel differently about this, if I were to predict hypertrophy outcomes, if I were able to measure them to a super granular degree in somebody whose training is set up really favorably and I had a good study with enough power to determine these kind of differences between people, then I would expect that somebody who trains intelligently using exercises like a progressively loaded leg extension would actually experience a greater degree of muscle hypertrophy of the rectus femoris compared with somebody who exclusively relied on squatting, even if it is full depth squatting. And this has actually been studied. There have been studies looking at what's called regional hypertrophy of different muscles, like the vastus muscles, vastus lateralis versus the rectus femoris, versus the hamstring muscle complex, for example. And incidentally, the hamstrings are another set of biarticular muscles that cross the hip and the knee just on the other side, on the backside. And so when it's been examined with squatting, for example, the vastus muscles, which originate on the femur and then insert past the knee joint, they get significant strength gains and muscle growth from full depth squatting. Rectus femoris, on the other hand, doesn't tend to grow a ton from full depth squatting. Neither do the hamstrings, actually. As much as some people would like to frame, the back squat as an excellent hamstring exercise, it actually doesn't appear to be the case for similar reasons, this kind of biarticular nature, that at the same time that it is, involved in hip extension, there is also knee extension going on down below. And so that's kind of the take home is, if you are a general, fitness enthusiast, a general trainee, somebody training for our least favorite phrase here, quote unquote, general strength, or just healthy aging, you want to maintain your function, I don't think you are likely to experience a significant difference in your quality of life, your outcomes, your aging, et cetera, by not doing that exercise. But there is not a situation where if I were hypothetically a bodybuilding coach, which I am not, but if I were in charge of somebody's training and they were concerned with maximizing the hypertrophy of their quadriceps muscles, I would not recommend to them, hey, all we need to do is just full depth squatting and we'll get maximum hypertrophy of all of the quadriceps muscles, all of the hamstring muscles, everything, just from that exercise choice alone. I would choose other variation But again, you know, the question was like, are squats and one-legged work enough? Well, it depends on what that one-legged work is. If it's a single leg split squat, you're dealing with the same issue. You still have hip flexion and knee, you know, flexion going on at the same time. And so that's unlikely to generate the biggest hypertrophy outcome. So I would be doing those kinds of exercises, yes, but I would also be including progressively loaded leg extensions as well as part of a purely hypertrophy-oriented program.
Yeah, we agree. I just think there are different considerations and constraints when it comes to programming for hypertrophy only versus strength only, and then also even within general strength versus specific strength. And so that really depends how you define general strength. And general strength, in our view, is the ability to produce muscular force in a wide variety of different contexts and tasks. That's how you would measure this sort of general strength, right? So it's not just going to be training the squat and the deadlift and then measuring strength in the squat and the deadlift. That's an example of very specific sort of strength training, especially if we're talking about just one rep maxes. Rather, you would have a variety of different tasks, a variety of different rep ranges, velocities, et cetera, and that would be more representative of a, quote, general strength, a broad strength base. And I actually think there's a pretty nice overlap when it comes to, you know, general hypertrophy training principles, where you'd want to choose multiple exercises that train the muscle through relatively large range of motion. Doesn't really matter if it's, you know, an inch or two different as far as the, you know, range of motion. But if there's a big difference, that's probably where it starts to matter more. You'd want to select exercises that work the muscle or muscle groups through different angles, using different angles and using different rep ranges as well, and be able to train them at a relatively high volume compared to the person's current sort of tolerance. And so that's all general hypertrophy training principles. So it wouldn't just be one exercise like squats only, right? Or it wouldn't be leg extensions only. So in order to maximize muscular hypertrophy, you'd want to include multiple different exercises. And if we're talking about quadriceps hypertrophy in general, certainly the rectus femoris is one of those muscles that you'd want to actively train. Leg extension would be a good option. I actually favor it over the sissy squat because it's easier to load and get somewhere close to failure, which is probably another criteria for general hypertrophy training. It'd just be really difficult for many people to even do a sissy squat. And even if they did an assisted one or something like that, it would then be hard to load and probably be less accessible than just a leg extension. But as far as how that transfers over to like leg strength, again, it depends how you're measuring it. If you're measuring leg strength via a leg extension, which many, you know, sort of research papers have done, yeah, probably pretty good transference. Increases leg strength. But if you're measuring strength via one rep max sort of squat, I don't know that you're missing much by not doing leg extensions. Yes, it is one exercise that probably increases the rectus femoris hypertrophy more than other certain types of exercises, particularly, you know, bilateral squat-based exercises. That should tell you something about the squat. It's just not limited by the rectus femoris and its hypertrophy. And, you know, certainly hypertrophy, muscular hypertrophy, increase of muscle, cross-sectional area, that's one of the ways in which people can get stronger, right? The functional unit of the muscle, you get more of that, and so you can produce more force. But it has to be highly coordinated, right? So you can't just gain a bunch of muscle size via the leg extension, right? And then pray that your squat goes up. It just needs to be highly coordinated. So if you are gaining muscle size and it's highly coordinated because you're still practicing the test, the way that you're going to sort of assess somebody's strength level, yeah, likely to transfer over pretty well. But just getting bigger muscles without it being highly coordinated and skilled at the way that you're going to test strength is probably not going to work.
Yeah. If the rectus femoris was a major contributor to squat performance, then we would expect it to respond to squat training. That it does not appear to respond robustly to squat training suggests it's not a major participant or contributor. And so my argument for actually continuing to include something like a leg extension, even in like my own training, where I'm not oriented around maximum hypertrophy, I would prefer to squat heavier weights when I'm, you know, for most of my training, and I tend to maintain leg extensions in. And for me, it's generally related to the fact that I have experienced quad and patellar tendinopathy in the past, and so this represents a tool for some additional variation to build up capacity of the area to tolerate loading in a bunch of different ways, and also to whatever extent that, you know, applying some direct, some very directed, you know, force to that area in that way, it might mitigate the risk of recurrence in the future. And so rather than just saying, I want to squat more, so I will do the same squat pattern, you know, 3, 4, 5, whatever, every single training session, without any variation. It's a tool for that and to build up and maintain tissue capacity in other ways. So that's why I continue to use leg extensions in my training. Also, like, the pump you get from those things is pretty legit. But for me, it's the quad and patellar tendons that I've dealt with issues before, and I found it useful for that purpose. Same when it comes to rehabilitation as well. I've used them in that context. And I know that our rehab guys, you know, it's not going to form a major component of like early post-operative rehab for people with knee, you know, surgical issues of any kind or ACLs and things like that. That's actually something they tend to, you know, not use a ton of very early on, but later on, it will likely form at least a component of training for those individuals, because quadriceps strength in general, not necessarily broken down by the specific each of the individual quads, but is predictive of, you know, their successful surgical outcomes after a knee surgery and things like that. So I would be using it there as well in the later stages.
Yeah, I agree. Leg extensions have a place in a lot of people's programming. And so the way that I would program this, you know, from a general strength and hypertrophy promoting, you know, sort of perspective, if somebody has three sort of squat slots that they're going to use per week in their training program right now, I would pick one version that's probably a sort of freestanding squat variation if they are on board with that. So something like a barbell back squat. Front squat would also work. I tend to lean more towards the back squat. You can load it pretty heavy, big range of motion, trains a lot of muscle mass. And so that would probably be best suited to a lower rep range. We'll call it, you know, somewhere in that 3 to 6 rep range. You can train that maybe primarily for maximal low velocity strength. That would probably be a good selection. And then the secondary squat sort of slot would be a little bit less fatiguing, ideally, that maybe has a predilection towards a slightly higher rep range, or at least doesn't get too fatiguing or too limited by cardiorespiratory sort of fitness at a higher rep range. So something like a hack squat, something like a pendulum squat, leg press. Again, if you were trying to bias this towards quadriceps hypertrophy, the third slot would be, you know, something like a leg extension. That would be a totally fine movement. Again, if quadriceps hypertrophy and hypertrophy was like one of your major goals. If it wasn't, if you were thinking about, you know, squat strength as measured by a back squat, maybe it's a split squat or something unilateral. And as far as sissy squats, I just don't really program them that often. I think, you know, yes, they can be useful for some folks. The problem is if they can do them, so they have all the mobility, they have the coordination, the strength, et cetera, to do them already, well, then it's hard to load, right? Somewhere in that maybe 5 to 25-ish rep range, it's hard to load them and get somewhere near failure during that. And then other folks can't do them, period. And so it's kind of a non-starter right there.
For sure. Yeah, I will occasionally do them, but they're only in the context of rehab for myself. And then I actually don't tend to program them that often, even for like rehab clients, because most of them suck at it and are going to get frustrated by it, unless it's somebody who is pretty athletic and has an interest in improving that ability. But yeah, generally unloaded for, you know, I do them anywhere from 6 to 15 reps or something like that. And sometimes I'll even have my hand on like the upright of a squat rack or something while I do it, just to facilitate the balance. But it's purely because of, again, like tendon, quad tendon or patellar tendon type stuff that I'm might be managing at the time. But it's not something that I would choose as a primary hypertrophy movement. I would 10 out of 10. Yeah. Leg extension all day.
Good feedback. All right, well, let's move on to the next question. Greg Knuckles recently posted a very thorough, or at least long, review of the science on protein intake, making the case that intakes higher than what you guys usually recommend are needed to maximize gains, and that the 1.6 grams of protein per kilogram body weight per day number isn't really that well supported. Do the arguments made by Greg update your recommendation in any way? Why or why not? Yeah, so a special shout out to Greg Knuckles. I thought the piece was excellent, and yes, he does typically write very thorough and long pieces. Sometimes pieces are long and not thorough, and some pieces are thorough, not very long, but he does both, and we appreciate him for that. As far as my take on this, I'll cut right to the chase and say that I actually don't think that the arguments made by Greg, while I acknowledge them and appreciate the fact that he wrote that piece, I don't think that they actually make us change our recommendation for protein intake, mainly because our recommendation has been very wide from the get-go. It's currently 1.6 grams of protein per kilogram total body weight per day as a sort of bottom level, right, a floor, up to about 3.1 grams of protein per kilogram body weight per day. And so I think that range is still fine. And I think, you know, when you read our protein recommendations, we continue to harp on there are some individuals who will benefit from higher levels of protein intake, particularly people who are training very hard for a lot of volume or spending many hours per week training. And if they're in a calorie deficit, and if they're otherwise not eating a lot of high quality protein. And so those folks may benefit from slightly higher intakes. So with that in mind, let's kind of walk through the history of that 1.6 grams of protein per kilogram body weight per day number and kind of give some thoughts on it. The recommendation of 1.6 grams per kilo per day, well, that comes from Morton's meta-analysis. I think it was published in 2017. It's often cited as evidence that protein intakes greater than that number, greater than 1.6 grams per kilo per day, did not further contribute to hypertrophy. And this was determined by plotting the change in fat-free mass gains against baseline protein intake. So a few caveats. One, fat-free mass is not the same thing as muscle mass. Fat-free mass is everything that's not fat. So yes, it includes skeletal muscle, but it also includes water, glycogen, bone, non-muscle organ tissue, et cetera, right? So it's not just the same thing. Next, the 1.6 grams per kilo per day is the sort of was the break point that the researchers came up with, and that sits between two confidence intervals, a lower confidence interval and a higher confidence interval. And so it is likely that the sort of, quote, optimal intake for hypertrophy is somewhere between these two confidence intervals. The lower end was 1.03 and the upper end was 2.2. So it is possible that a slightly lower or higher range could be useful, right? So that's just kind of, what the data is saying. And the third problem that is not unique to this data set, but just nutritional studies in general, it's difficult to assess protein intake in free living individuals. Dietary records are obtained by self-report, and people are notoriously not good at nutritional reporting, in this case, protein intake. So no surprise there. There's some squish in the data. But when people were generally asking, you know, hey, how much protein do I need in order to get the most out of my training? And we're thinking about the general public here, I still think that 1.6 grams per kilo per day is likely to be fine. The bigger lever that most people need to pull with respect to gaining muscle mass is not more protein, it's more resistance training. If you consider that the average protein intake in the United States is over 1 gram of protein per kilogram body weight per day, but most adults don't lift weights, well, they can, you know, take more protein until the cows come home. But if they're not lifting weights, they're not going to gain muscle mass. So first and foremost, we want people to do resistance training. And then after that, we think they should add a little bit more protein to their diet. Ideally, this happens at the same time. But look, if we're picking one sort of behavior or practice to change first, it's got to be lifted weights. And you know, then if we can get them to take in some more protein, that would be great too. As far as what amount of protein that people need per day in order to optimize or maximize sort of muscular hypertrophy, muscular strength, or cardiorespiratory fitness, that's going to vary. You know, human biology is messy. I assume that Dr. Baraki is going to talk about that here in a second. But the main thing here is, you know, there's not going to be a single, you know, numerical recommendation that applies best for all folks. 1.6 is a reasonable sort of floor, but yeah, some people are going to need more. And you know, I think the harder that you're training, the leaner that you are, the lower your sort of energy intake is. As far as are you in a calorie deficit? Are you at maintenance? You're probably going to need a little bit more protein compared to somebody who is in a surplus. And finally, people who are eating relatively poor sources of protein. It's not that you can't gain muscle. It's not that you can't gain strength. It's not that you can't gain cardiorespiratory fitness on a plant-based diet. That's certainly possible. And I think that if you're eating 1.6 grams of protein per kilo per day, you're probably getting a decent amount out of your training, but you might benefit from a little bit more. And that's fine too. I just think that, you know, drawing a line in the sand at 1.6 grams of protein per kilogram body weight per day and saying, look, that's all you need and there's no wiggle room there. Well, those weren't our initial recommendations anyway. And sure, I think it's fine to push back against that. But our initial recommendation was, hey, try to get at least 1.6 grams of protein per kilogram body weight per day. You may need more, up to somewhere around 3 grams of protein per kilogram body weight per day. And that's fine too. I don't know. Dr. Baraki, what do you think?
Yeah, I think it's fine. And if you go back, you know, many years, if not decades, people in the fitness space who were among that population of hard training, motivated people, they would just say a gram per pound. And it's like, okay, that's at that higher end of that range, 2.2, that's fine. Go for that. You know, we're okay with that. The two things I would point out here, because I more often am face to face with this, not just gen pop, but like clinical populations. And the idea that I'm going to take most of my clinical population and convince them to increase their routine habitual daily, you know, protein intake up to that range, definitely, you know, up to 2.2, if not even just up to 1.6, it's slim for a lot of them. And so I'm like content with a lot of the clinical folks, if I can get them up to, you know, greater than 1.2 to 1.4, I'm like, okay, cool. Like I'll call that a win, especially if the sources of that protein are displacing less healthy alternative kind of energy sources or even protein sources. The last thing I'll mention here is, you know, let's swap out some of the terms here. So here we're talking about, like, you know, the recommended level of protein intake for, you know, these, say, hypertrophy outcomes. What if I just did a Mad Lib here and swapped out and said volume in terms of sets per week for muscle hypertrophy outcomes? And somebody was like, well, you know, is 1.6 enough? And that's just like somebody asking us, hey, for muscle hypertrophy, is 4 sets enough? And it's like, eh. Biology is complicated. There's a lot of variation here. You know, there's going to be ranges. Different people are going to respond to different levels of intake. Even within people, their response to a given intervention is going to vary over time, depending on a host of variables. Their sleep and their nutritional status and their training and all sorts of other factors that are at play. And so that's why, you know, these things are necessarily going to be fuzzy. All right. So there's, you know, even if we settled and we said, oh, we're going to modify our recommendation, instead of 1.6, it's going to be 2.2. That's going to be more than some people need and probably less than other people need. Right. And there's no way of confidently predicting that in advance, in the same way that, you know, when we start working with a coaching client, as I did, you know, just this past weekend, started with a new client, and I had to come up with a place to start in terms of their training volume, right? And there is a non-zero chance that I'm giving him a little more than he needs. There's a non-zero chance that I'm giving him a little less than he needs. I'm trying to land somewhere in the middle and then iteratively figure that out over time, adjust over time. It's a little bit harder, I think, to do that with dietary protein, because identifying, you know, the precise impact of varying grams of protein per day and confidently assessing that for yourself is challenging. It might take longer stretches of time. It might take just experimenting with different dietary patterns that lead to higher levels or lower levels and see if you notice anything or if you feel better. I think that I generally feel better. Purely subjective, arguably, you know, some placebo effect with higher, it might have to do with a food displacement effect of what I'm eating, you know, from a protein source instead of an alternative that I might not prefer. So I think that, you know, it would be nice if we could distill down all of these, you know, quote unquote optimal recommendations to, here is the precise number of grams you need. Here are the precise number of reps you need. Here are the precise numbers of sets you need. Here are the precise numbers of minutes of sleep you need. But biology doesn't work that way between people or within people. And so there's going to be some fuzziness. And I think that that's why, you know, to some people's frustration, they will hear folks in this space speak with what they might deem to be like weasel words, you know, to hedge a little bit, to give ranges, to say it may lead to better, you know, things like that. But that's biology. Sorry.
Hi, I'm Dr. Jordan Feigenbaum, founder of Barbell Medicine. And over the last 10 plus years in business, we've built a team of amazing professionals that includes physicians, physical therapists, dietitians, and strength coaches that are available to help you reach your goals. Whether it's strength and muscle gain, weight management, or recovering from an injury, we have some of the best coaches in the game and have worked with people from all walks of life. From teens to grandparents and beginners to elite level athletes, our experienced team of professionals work together to meet you where you're at and give you what you need to succeed. That's the Barbell Medicine difference. If you're not sure exactly what you need, take the quiz linked in the description below or send us an email, support@barbellmedicine.com, and we'll get you sorted. From all of us here at Barbell Medicine, we look forward to hearing from you. We'd love to help. When you're trapped in a cycle of stressful, unwanted thoughts and repetitive behaviors that are taking over your life, that's how it can feel for individuals with obsessive compulsive disorder, or OCD, which is so much more than the stereotypes about liking things clean and organized. It's a seriously and highly misunderstood condition with two main symptoms: intrusive thoughts and compulsions that cause anxiety or distress. The intrusive thoughts are unwanted thoughts that feel disturbing, stressful, and totally out of character. They can be about anything, but often focus on people or things that we care about, making them hard to ignore. People with OCD often feel like they have to do something to relieve the anxiety from those thoughts. So they'll engage in compulsions, which are repetitive physical or mental behaviors like checking, asking for assurance, following strict routines, or mentally reviewing things over and over. Because there are so many misconceptions, a lot of people don't know that they have it, and they feel shame about their symptoms and suffer in silence. Plus, not every therapist understands OCD or is qualified to treat it effectively, which can make it difficult to find the right help. I can't stress enough how important it is to get the right kind of care, because just like a great workout program can transform your body, the right mental health care can transform your mind, and ultimately, the individual's life. OCD is highly treatable with a specialized type of therapy called ERP, or exposure and response prevention. With NoCD, you can do live virtual ERP therapy with licensed therapists who specialize in ERP and OCD, so they can truly understand what you're going through, even the symptoms that feel hard to talk about. NoCD makes this life-changing treatment affordable and accepts more than 60 insurance plans, enabling over 155 million Americans to access evidence-based treatment at NoCD covered by insurance. And between therapy sessions, you'll have NoCD's powerful in-app support. If you or someone you love is struggling with OCD, you're not alone, and with the right care, you can get better. To find out more about therapy with NoCD, go to nocd.com and book a free 15-minute call with their team. That's nocd.com to learn more and book a free call. This podcast is brought to you by Factor Meals. While we all know that nutrition is huge when it comes to health and performance, we don't always have time to shop for and prepare healthy meals. Are you ready to optimize your nutrition this year? Let Factor help you take the stress out of eating healthy so that you can hit your goals. Skip the grocery store, skip the prep work and the cooking fatigue, and instead get fresh, chef-crafted, dietitian-approved meals delivered right to your door. Factor lets you choose from a ton of different meal plans, including 40 options across 8 different dietary patterns. When things get hectic, Factor is flexible. You can change your order up every week with plans from 4 to 18 meals per week, or pause, or even reschedule your deliveries at any time. And check this out, Factor is cheaper than eating takeout and dining out. Reach your goals this year with ingredients you can trust and convenience that can't be beat. If you want a helping hand with your nutrition, head to factormeals.com/factorpodcast and use code BBM50 to get 50% off. That's code BBM50 at factormeals.com/factorpodcast to get 50% off. This podcast is brought to you by Rosetta Stone. We're almost 2 months into 2025, which probably means that you're reflecting on your New Year's resolutions. Whether you're traveling, advancing your career, or just love learning, speaking a new language in 2025 is a great goal, and Rosetta Stone makes it easier than ever. Rosetta Stone is the most trusted language learning program for 30 years. With millions of users and 25 languages offered, it's also one of the best. It's available on desktop or as an app, so you can learn anytime, anywhere, and it uses an immersive experience to help you learn the language of your choice quickly, along with the correct accent using its true accent speech recognition technology. It's like having a personal trainer for your accent. Additionally, Rosetta Stone is offering 50% off a lifetime membership, which is an incredible deal. Don't wait, you can unlock your language learning potential now. Barbell Medicine listeners can grab Rosetta Stone's lifetime membership for 50% off. That's unlimited access to 25 language courses for life. Visit rosettastone.com/today to get started and claim 50% off today. Don't miss out. Go to rosettastone.com/today and start learning now. All right, next question here on our fifth Ask Me Anything for our Barbell Medicine Plus subscribers. I'm here with Dr. Austin Baraki. Any suggestions for books on coaching in general and strength coaching in particular? Yeah, this is a question I've gotten a lot of times on my Instagram Ask Me Anythings, on my live Q&As, at our seminars, et cetera. Like, what books do you recommend so I can learn how to program and coach the lifts? And so what I'm going to do is drop a list of books in the show notes below because I don't want to miss any of the books that I think are useful. But what I want to say about these books is that I don't know that any of them are exactly what I would personally be looking for, in that something kind of marries the current evidence in exercise science and also practically applies that in a way that is accessible for most folks. So for example, you could talk about proximity to failure, right, and go through all the data that we currently have on proximity to failure or training volume or training intensity for various goals, whether it's strength, hypertrophy, cardiorespiratory fitness, et cetera. So you can go through all the evidence. That's well and good. But then how do you actually like put that into a program for a particular individual? And so marrying those things together, I think, is useful. And then next, how do you go about troubleshooting a person's programming by manipulating these variables? And so that does not currently exist. That is what I've been working on with respect to the programming text. A iteration of that, it currently exists in the Low Fatigue ebook. So it's about a 90-page ebook that I came up with. It's my sort of programming treatise for strength. Same thing for the General Strength Conditioning 2 ebook. That's my sort of treatise on conditioning programming. And so you put those two together, that would be like the programming book from Barbell Medicine version 1.0. And then, you know, this other longer book I'm currently fleshing out right now, and hopefully that's available at some point soon. I want to get it out there because I think it's useful. It would have helped me a lot when I first came into the coaching sort of arena, and hopefully you guys like that too. So yeah, check out the list in the description below, all the books that I have read and that I would recommend. But again, just to be clear, I'm not vetting every single sentence in these books. I've recommended these books before, and people will send me screenshots and be like, I can't believe that you recommended this book. look, you really agree with that? I'm like, look, I'm not signing off on every sentence in there. There's obviously some updates that have happened. Some of these books are a little older. Some of them are newer, but you know, still not necessarily supported by evidence. And so you can take something from everywhere and use it. But I just think there's not a current singular resource that would be like, yep, bang on, do this one. So check out the list of books in the description below. I've read way too many of these things. I think Dr. Baraki's is more well-adjusted than I am with respect to reading stuff. But I'll be interested to hear what you say on your book recommendations, Dr. B.
Well, if you want these texts to incorporate evidence, you know, modern evidence, then those are going to have a hard time doing it because those are old texts at this point. And so what you described as far as what you're looking for, it sounds like a book pitch of something that you plan you/we ought to write. My take on this question is less from the perspective that you are taking in terms of nuts and bolts of writing a training program towards a particular outcome, and more so to the bigger picture process of like the client coach relationship dynamic and things like that. And so I think that there are probably two resources I would suggest there. One is the one we've talked about ad nauseum many other places before, just concepts in motivational interviewing. Getting skilled at that is very useful for coaches who are working with clients from all different walks and dealing with all sorts of issues. And then even though it is not necessarily from a strength barbell sport background, I think that you probably can't go wrong with Steve Magnus's stuff. He has several books that he's written, some very specific to running, like The Science of Running, but that's one of his older texts at this point. He's had several newer ones since then that have taken more of a sports and performance kind of psychology bent to them. Which, yeah, most useful, I think, for competitors who are trying to eke out, you know, performance at the highest level, who are trying to perform under pressure, things like that. But there may also be, you know, motivated general population trainees who benefit from some of those things, especially insofar as everyone deals with setbacks and challenges along the way. So I'm coming at it a little bit more from the relationship dynamics and sport performance psychology aspect. And so those are a couple of the resources I would suggest for people.
Let's move on to the next question here. Recently seen a transition from some older biomedical diagnoses for the musculoskeletal system, such as subacromial impingement syndrome and chondromalacia patella, to more general ones with less emphasis on the structural components like rotator cuff related shoulder pain and patellofemoral pain syndrome. How do you respond to patients that still want a more traditional diagnosis to make sense of their symptoms? And would you expect them to do worse with conservative care due to the negative beliefs that come from such diagnoses? We're going to turn this over to our senior pain and rehab specialist, Dr. Derek Miles. What say you?
I don't know that I would necessarily consider this a recent transition, but it has been gaining steam. If anything, it helps with the explanation that it's not just a structural issue. If a patient wants a structural diagnosis or comes to clinic with a prior one, that is okay. I typically wouldn't expect anyone to do worse depending on what they've been told, but it might key in on some topics that need work through. Day one is much more about establishing relationship as much as anything else and working to gain trust and rapport. I'm not going to come out hot out of the gate trying to explain to someone that it likely isn't their insert X causing their symptoms. I may, however, start talking about base rates and other factors that might be contributing to their symptoms. Moving towards the syndrome vernacular does make it easier to talk about the subtle difference between cause and contribute. There isn't a universal response that can be given, as we really have to understand where the athlete is at before generating it. There are plenty of athletes that have been told a structural diagnosis and put no stock in it at all. So if I take the same approach as I would for someone who absolutely believes that one single thing is the cause, it's not likely going to work. It really is no different than telling individuals that just getting stronger is going to make them feel better. Both are overly reductionist for what's really going on, and part of the process is getting into the nuance. More than any negative beliefs per se, I would say that trying to have conversations with individuals who have concrete beliefs is overall more problematic, even if those beliefs are technically correct. Really, the overall move towards syndromes has given us a lot more freedom for using different entry points and different points of discussion to try and make progress with the individual athlete.
Last question here on the Barbell Medicine Podcast with Dr. Austin Baraki. If someone is only interested in testing maximal strength for their deadlift, as in a deadlift-only meet, is there need for specific programming or is regular powerlifting training just as good? I particularly wonder what adjustments, if any, would be made to squat training. Yeah, this is a good question, and I think it really depends on a few factors. So one, how long does the person have before the meet? Two, how well trained is the individual? And then three, like, what is the training that the individual has been doing, leading up to this? So let's just assume, for the sake of this discussion, the person has been training with a, powerlifting type program. So lots of exposure to the squat, the bench press, the deadlift. They've been doing single rep efforts weekly on all of those movement patterns, and they have 2 weeks to go to the meet, before the deadlift only meet. So then what should they do? In this case, one, I'm removing any single rep efforts from the squat and the bench press, not because those are sort of bad or ultimately unnecessary for powerlifting, but they're unnecessary for a deadlift only meet. And they cost some fatigue. They take up some training resources. And if the idea is how much can you deadlift in 2 weeks, we don't need to, quote, waste those resources in this particular setting. So I'm getting rid of any single rep exposures for the squat and the bench press. And then the next change I'm making is I'm going to reduce the squat volume. By how much depends on their previous training. So if somebody was doing, let's say, a top single at RP 8 and then 5 sets of 4 reps at 70% or something like that as their back off for squat training, I'm skipping the single. I'm just going to have them do 2 or 3 sets of 4 reps at 70% in that case. For the deadlift training, because we're also getting ready for, this meet, we're 2 weeks out, we need to do a taper, and I want to keep the single rep exposure, and I'm probably going to actually double that up. So instead of single at 8 and then 5 sets of 4 reps at 70%, it's going to be a single at 8, 2 or 3 sets of 4 reps at probably a higher percentage. Something like 75% is probably how I would do this, so I didn't make too big of a jump in intensity. And then I'm going to do a single at 7 afterwards, just to get another exposure to that single rep effort. So a sort of fatigue single. That's probably how I would do that. Bench press, I would just remove the single, keep the volume the same. And then the week of the meet, I would probably do 1 set of squats at 70%. I'm going to work up to the last warm-up on the deadlift. So that should be a single at like 80, 83%, something like that. And then the bench training, I'm just going to do 2 or 3 sets of 4 reps at 70-something percent, whatever the program would call for. That's going to be about 4 or 5 days out of the meet, before the meet. And then 2 or 3 days before the meet, I might have the person go in there and, do a few singles on the deadlift up to like 65, 70% just to get the blood flowing, go to the meet in 2 days and pull. You could also just skip that session. It really just depends on how the person's recovering and feeling leading up to the meet. So that's a sort of short-term type thing. If longer-term thing, so we have, let's say, 8 weeks, so then what? In that case, the training program would look about the same up until about 4 to 6 weeks out. And then I would think about a deadlift only, sort of specialization program, which for our Barbell Medicine Plus subscribers, I've put a deadlift only sort of specialization block. It's 6 weeks long. You can download that under the posts selection. And if you're not a Barbell Medicine Plus subscriber, well, look, again, we're running that promotion to the end of February. You can sign up, go download it, and, go deadlift a house. As far as differences that are specific to this type of program compared to a 3-lift powerlifting type program, the bench is basically the same. Again, the only thing I'm doing is removing any sort of single rep efforts from that. That would definitely be in a normal traditional powerlifting meet preparation. I just don't think there's a reason to expend that sort of effort and time on bench press singles. Also, to the extent that people overshoot their single on bench press and maybe they push through their legs quite a bit, there's some low back fatigue there. Just don't want to deal with it in the context of a deadlift only meet. Similarly, there are no singles for the squat type training. As far as what's happening to the squat training itself, one of the ways that we typically program our squat slots, the amount of squats that people are doing per week, we have, again, a priority squat. That's typically the competition squat, so squat with belt. We have a secondary squat. That's typically something like a pause squat or pin squat, safety squat bar squat, squat plus chain, squat plus band, something like that. That type of squat variation I'm going to select for either a squat variation that I suspect would have more transference to the deadlift, so something like a Zercher squat or a good morning or a front squat. Alternatively, I'm going to pick a squat variation that is less fatiguing to the back, so something like a belt squat, a leg press, something like that. It really just depends on the individual. For sumo lifters, would probably pick something that is more quad biased. For conventional deadlifters, I'm probably going to pick something that either transfers more to the deadlift, at least that I would assume, or is ultimately a little bit less stressful. It just depends on the individual, as far as how much deadlift training can they tolerate. That's going to kind of guide my management there. As far as the tertiary squat, the third squat slot, which typically falls on day 2 of our 4-day programs, in movement number 3, I'm picking one that
generally doesn't load the back very much. So again, something like a belt squat, something like a leg press, or machine based variation, something like that. As far as how much deadlifting the person's going to do, it's probably not going to be much more than they were doing previously, or would otherwise do in a three lift type program. There's going to be more exposure to singles, so I would potentially include singles on the accessory deadlift or supplemental deadlift rather. So again, it depends on how the person pulls and also how much loading they can tolerate. If this person is very, very well trained and we're not really worried about over fatiguing their trunk and their back in particular, then I may increase volume those first 2 weeks of this sort of 6 week training program. But you'll see in the example, it doesn't look like it's anything extreme. We're starting off with a single and you know, four back offsets on the deadlift. I didn't really go crazy there because I don't think most people have trained with a ton of volume on their deadlift, and so I didn't want to kind of send it for this public-facing program. And then, yeah, you'll just see a slow taper up until this deadlift-only meet. The other big difference is going to be the final week, where I have people work up to, again, that last warm-up about 4 to 5 days out before the meet, and then instead of having a sort of sharpening session 2 or 3 days prior to the meet, I'm just taking the rest of the week off. It's not that I think the deadlift is more fatiguing per se. I just think there's been less sort of development of deadlift-specific training tolerance for most folks, and because the squat also imparts a significant amount of fatigue on the low back, and you want to be fresh when it comes time to go do that third attempt at the deadlift only meet. Austin, what do you think?
I think that a couple of variables here for me. One is the person a conventional deadlifter or a sumo deadlifter? That actually would impact a little bit in terms of what the kind of contributors and limiters of their performance tend to be. So, you know, as far as somebody tends to be a conventional deadlifter, then I think that sparing unnecessary back fatigue from squat training becomes a higher priority. For somebody who's a sumo deadlifter, that's a little bit, it's not a concern, but it's a little bit less of a concern, particularly if they're the kind of sumo deadlifter who can achieve a super upright back position. And especially for that lifter, I think that I would definitely want to maintain a high amount of quad training for a sumo deadlifter, because that's an important aspect of initiating that lift. But it might switch to a way of quad training that actually spares the back. So like, I would love a box squat, or a belt squat, or like, I don't know if you remember a few years back when like the pit shark was like the hot thing in powerlifting, right? Yeah, so I would probably, I mean, if it were me in that situation, I'd probably drop down to squatting once a week. I don't know that I would maintain a second actual full squat weight on my back type session, but it might be some other form of like lower leg, hip, quad training that actually spares the back, using something like a belt squat or a pit shark or something like that. And then, you know, as far as how much deadlifting to be doing, that's definitely going to be a pretty individual thing, because I don't actually think that for most people to quote unquote optimize their deadlift performance that they need to be like deadlifting three times a week or something like that. When my deadlift was at its absolute strongest, I was deadlifting twice a week. I was squatting twice a week. And then on other days of the week, there were some accessory movements that could kind of sort of look like those things, but they were very much accessory movements. So like, I was routinely deadlifting, pulling singles in the range of, you know, upper 600, 700 range and a bunch of back offsets twice a week, on once conventional and once sumo. But my accessory day or whatever would have been like maybe sets of 8 to 12 RDLs with like anywhere from 275 to 315. And like, I literally never went heavier than that, because that wasn't the intent of that movement slot. And so I think that if I were doing, I would probably drop down to squatting once a week. I would deadlift twice a week, once, you know, in the main style, maybe once in a similar or potentially more different variation. And then definitely if the person's a sumo deadlifter, put a ton more quad work in that spares the back. If they're a conventional deadlifter, that's going to be a little bit less of important of a thing. At which point I'm more like, hey, when I watch you pull, do we have any kind of obvious limiters, or is it just like you need to get stronger overall? But I think that, you know, the deadlift is one of those exercises that, this is not terribly evidence-based, this is one of those when we get asked questions about what do you believe that's not directly supported by evidence, that you can get pretty darn far with deadlift training and performance on lower frequency than you can like the upper, like a overhead press development or something like that. That's just anecdotal, experiential. Like when I've coached people to their best press performances, when I've had my best pressing performances, it's tended to be more frequent exposure to that. And I think that with deadlifting, you can get away with a little bit less. And so I wouldn't necessarily crank the frequency up. I would be happy to increase the training volume, and especially in like a low fatigue style, if that's a way that somebody responds well to. So yeah, those are my modifications on your take, or how I would approach it.
Yeah, those are good recommendations. I think obviously a lot of the stuff's going to be individualized. I mean, I've had people deadlift 5 times a week, you know, where we're really trying to work on some technique type stuff, especially on the single rep, right? These are the people, you know, where I make them do each one of their repetitions on the deadlift as a single rep. They do one rep, they take a step back, set up, do it again, because getting the technique right the first time is really important in a powerlifting meet. So something like that would be like, all right, set a clock for 7 or 8 minutes and work up to a single at RP 6 or 7, something like that. But you only have that amount of time and it's only one rep. And so there's just some practice, some skill type practice where the time is sort of preventing them from going too heavy, going too crazy. And again, they got to get the technique right. But in any event, check out the deadlift only program. It's under the posts section on the Barbell Medicine Plus website on Supercast. And tag us in your new deadlift PRs. We want to see them. That is a wrap here on the Barbell Medicine Podcast, where we bring modern medicine to strength and conditioning and strength and conditioning to modern medicine. I'm your host, Dr. Jordan Feigenbaum. Special shout out to Dr. Austin Baraki for joining us on this week's podcast. Before you guys go anywhere, please leave us a 5-star rating and a review. It really helps drive traffic to our podcast so we can keep bringing you all the latest nuance in health and fitness. From everyone here at Barbell Medicine, we'll catch you next week and every week right here on the Barbell Medicine Podcast.
Big news, everyone. We just released 2 new training programs. First up, our second generation Strength One program, which is designed for folks who are trying to get stronger on the squat, the bench press, the deadlift, and the overhead press. It includes 4 12-week programs, and users can now pick their own exercises, choose between 3 or 4 day options, and choose to focus on either the bench press or the overhead press, in addition to the squat and the deadlift. The programming has also been overhauled to drive better results based on testing and user feedback. Next, we also launched our second generation Time Crunch program, which is designed for busy professionals, parents, and other on-the-go lifters who want to maximize results without spending hours upon hours in the gym. This one includes 6 12-week programs, ranging from longer workouts that are performed 2 days per week to shorter workouts performed daily and everything in between. No matter what your availability is, we have something for you. Both programs can be done with basic gym equipment like a bar, rack, and weights, but they can also be modified to use more specialized equipment in the gym if you like. Both programs also include a brand new ebook that includes details on the program, training theory, nutrition, supplements, and more. If you previously purchased the first generation of these programs, check your email for instructions on how to upgrade to the latest version. For everyone else who wants to get the most out of their training, head over to barbellmedicine.com and check out these new training programs.
Here from Barbell Medicine, and we'll get to the podcast in just a moment, but I wanted to take a second to plug a special promotion for Barbell Medicine Plus, our exclusive subscription service. From now until the end of February, we're offering 2 free months for new monthly subscribers or 40% off yearly memberships. If you hate these ads just as much as we do, you should know that Barbell Medicine Plus members get ad-free episodes, early access to our podcast, that's both audio and video, expert-written episode summaries, extended samples to our newest templates, access to a members-only podcast where Dr. Baraki and I answer your questions directly, and more exclusive content as well. If you want to support what we're doing and become a Barbell Medicine Plus member, now with a discount, head over to barbellmedicine.com/plus and sign up to be a Barbell Medicine Plus member today. That's barbellmedicine.com/plus to help us out and get rid of these ads for good. Thanks for your support. Now on to the podcast.